Hi, everybody. This is Mike Oppenheim, and you are listening to Coffin Talk, Interviews with the Living, a weekly podcast that explores how our views on death affect the way we live our lives. Today, I have Dr. Louie Kathy Zhang. She's a certified integrative life coach and hypnotist and hospice palliative care doctor. She combines the wisdom learned from caring for dying patients with the science of brain change to help high-achieving women of color clear limiting beliefs, dismantle perfectionism, imposter syndrome, and self-doubt, and create lasting change for more creativity, abundance, and love. She is an expert in death and dying, and that is the main impetus for the show. So, Dr. Zhang, or Kathy, as I'm going to call you for the rest of the interview, how are you doing?
I am great. Thank you so much for having me, Mike. Glad to be here.
Yeah. And we were introduced by a mutual contact, Hirsch Reppern, and I would be remiss if I didn't thank him because he's really, really incredible and awesome. And Hirsch, if you are listening to this, yes, I read all of your emails and you're hilarious. So I always want to write you and tell you that. But back to you, Kathy. My first question is the same for every guest, which is, how old are you? Where did you grow up? And what generation, if any, do you consider yourself a member of?
Absolutely. So I am 37. I was born in China, in Shanghai, but I grew up in New York, in Brooklyn. And I am squarely, if you consider my birth year, a millennial.
Awesome. Cool. And that's a great background. I love it. Well, for context, just because I don't know if Hirsch mentioned this, but I did volunteer in a hospice ward for about 3 or 4 years. So I have limited experience. I was doing like maybe 9-10 hours a week or something. But I'm always, I perk up when I hear that anyone has done that kind of work because I just think it's an interesting choice. So I'm going to start there. What brought you into hospice and palliative care in the first place?
Yeah, it's so I, out of residency, I trained in internal medicine and I wasn't exactly sure what I wanted to do. I thought I would do gastroenterology. Then I realized that I just didn't like the smell of poop as much as I thought I would. and then I thought I wanted to do something else. And so I was a hospitalist for several years, meaning I was a physician who took care of patients who were sick enough to be admitted to the hospital. And I loved that work. And at some point I realized it kind of felt like a revolving door of like, you know, almost like a patch-up job in the hospital. Like they would get sick, I would get them better, I would send them home, and then they would come back and I would do the same thing. And then I realized I didn't have the skills or the comfort level to be able to have those really difficult conversations. Like the, you know, I think I read a quote recently that was like, the source of a lot of tension in relationships is like a 10-minute uncomfortable conversation that no one wants to have. Mm-hmm. And I realized that I really wanted those skills and I wanted to do some deeper work with patients. And then I, followed around some colleagues in hospice and palliative care. I was like, hey, I think this might be good for me and how my brain is built and how I want to interact with people. And then 2019, I graduated from my fellowship, started work at the hospital where I am now. And then March 2020, not even a year into my first job as a palliative care attending or hospice doctor, you know, I'm in New York.
Oh, wow.
The pandemic happened. Yeah. And it was like the universe was like, oh, you like doing this kind of work? You like talking to seriously and or terminally ill patients about this kind of stuff? Like, well, okay, hold my beer. Here's a global pandemic for you. Yeah. So, yeah, wow. it was a wild time.
Yeah. Wow. That's so interesting. Were you like counseling yourself and counseling them, or were you just kind of, or did that help you distract yourself from it and just kind of focus on your work?
I would say the first probably few months, it was just adrenaline and go, 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 because it was just a huge influx of patients. I think our list back then of patients on a day-to-day basis was maybe in the 20s, and it just almost overnight, I think we got to a high of 89 and it just quadrupled. And when you're in that kind of environment, you don't have the time to do anything for yourself, eat, you know, or really realize what's going on. You're just running on autopilot. Mm-hmm. And so it really wasn't until I would say the summer when things started dying down. And then I was like, oh, we just went through something really wild. And how do we pick up the pieces from that? And but during the initial part, it was really just here's our training and this is what we're going to do. And we've never trained for this, but we'll just try to get by however we can.
Awesome. Yeah, that's great. And it's really interesting to me because we're still like close enough to it that it gets talked about a lot. And one of my jobs is I index books. So I just get like books that are about to be printed. And I'm like one of the last galley proofs. And in that process, I'm kind of seeing what people are writing. So I like, as the pandemic was like cresting, I was starting to get books written about it. And now I'm still getting a few. And I think what you said is like really important, which is that there's something to like being a part of something, even if it's like a disaster, even if it's something negative, but like holding out hope and just being there with humanity. So I'm curious, I am sure you get asked this all the time because I got asked it as a stupid volunteer, but like, do people ever say like, how can you possibly work with people who are dying? And I'm curious how you feel that answer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I get that question all the time. Right. And you've experienced that on your end, but, like some of it ranges on, yo, you must be an angel. You are an angel. Thank you so much. And then obviously I say thank you. And also sometimes I'll put in the caveat that I'm no angel. You know, I curse, I get frustrated, I honk at people in traffic. And at the same time, for me, what it boils down to is I want to feel all the things. Like I think it's, you know, it's curious that I was listening to some of your older episodes, and this theme of people who've had, or at least the one I was listening to, was the near-death experience mm-hmm. one.
Yeah.
And I had a near-death experience when I was 11 or 12.
Oh, wow.
And then ever since then, it's kind of just been like, you know what? I could be dead. And so if I'm alive, I want to feel and experience and do as much as I possibly can in this, you know, human existence. And so for me, like, there is nothing that is more real and raw and true of an expression of what it means to be human than the work that I'm doing, like death and dying, right? Mm-hmm. You want to see what someone is like angry, you give them some bad news or tell them what they don't want to hear, and they will get so angry at you. You want to see what love is like. On the flip side, there is so much love at the end of life mm-hmm. that it's almost overwhelming. And so I was like, this is what I want to do. It's tough. And yet is the most meaningful work that I could really ever imagine. And so that's kind of how I approach it.
Yeah, no, I love that answer. That was amazing. And I have to, you know, stop the entire podcast and just get into your NDE before we can move on, because I am not only fascinated, but I've been fascinated since childhood. And even though I sound eager to ask you about it, I would just like to state for the record that I'm not like hopeful that I have one, nor do I like look forward to one if I were to get one. But I am just curious about how your experience was compared to what I read about, which is obviously you already said something about it, which is it does compel you to think differently and live differently. But before you get into the how it changed you, can, if you don't mind, will you tell us what happened?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I was 11 or yeah, just about 11. It was the summer before high school, and we went to a water amusement park, like a theme park. Mm-hmm. And my parents took me and two of my friends. Their parents couldn't go, so it was, you know, my parents were the chaperones. And we were at a wave pool. And I guess, you know, when you venture into a wave pool, the waves come, you kind of like jump up, and then the waves carry you back a little bit, and you just repeat that for, you know, however long you want to be in there. And so I guess there was at one point where I ventured further into the pool where I guess there was kind of like a step off to the point where, you know, it was just a big, it got very pretty deep, and I didn't realize it, and I didn't know how to swim. And so I got swept under. And so for me, I didn't really experience kind of like the consciousness stuff or, you know, like seeing my life flash before my eyes. And again, I was 11.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Awareness of, you know, like all of this other stuff wasn't, if I had one now, I think it would be quite different. Mm-hmm. Obviously not saying that we want one,
yeah.
But what I do remember is I had watched a cartoon I don't know, months before or weeks before. And it was of this little boy who was fishing with his grandfather. And the little boy fell into the river. And then the grandfather was looking around trying to find him, and the kid was struggling. And this kid had, you know, it was a cartoon child, and he had three single strands of hair that were sticking straight up. And then the grandfather looked around, saw his three little strands of hair like break above the surface, and then plucked him like literally from those three strands of hair and plopped him back into the boat. And so I distinctly remember back then, I was like, if I can just get the top of my head close to the top of the water, then someone's going to save me. Oh, wow. And then the lifeguards came, and it turns out my other friends kind of got swept under at the same time. So not only was it like, did I almost drown? They stopped the the wave pool, and then everyone was staring at us. And then to add insult to injury, I'm like, why? Where were my parents? And to this day, I remember, I was like, Dad, why did the lifeguard save me? He's like, I saw all of you kind of go under at the same time, and I knew the lifeguard was closer to you, so I went to save you know, your friends, because like their parents entrusted me with the care of them, so you were fine. I had to make sure that, you know, I saved them. And I was like, okay, thanks, Dad.
It's so funny because I'm a father of three, and my two that are younger are like really young, and I 100% understand your dad's take, because I've actually said to Alana, who you met, my wife, many times that my biggest fear of the next phase of life is when we're in charge of other people's kids. Like, it's just, it's so scary. Even just like what food you serve them scares me, you know, like, are they going to go home and be like, he gave us apples, you know, like what is wrong with that man?
Right.
Wow. That is intense. Actually, I'm kind of curious. I'm going to ask a question I was planning on asking much later, but at the time when you were 11, so not now, but were you like religious? Was your family religious or spiritual at all? Or did you have any sort of concept of like the other side and dying?
At that time, so my mom is, my great great grandmother was very like a devout Buddhist, very involved in that. My grandmother less so, my mother less so. But I think we, at that time, it wasn't really anything that registered in my head. But ever since then, and then especially working in hospice and palliative care, like my perception and concept of death and dying and the spiritual realm and what happens after this physical plane of existence has greatly, greatly shifted. But back then, I didn't really have much of an idea of anything beyond what we were experiencing in the present.
Okay. And then I guess it's probably proper to ask you, so what has shifted, and are you religious or spiritual now?
So I would say like now I am probably as spiritual as someone who, let's say, follows organized religion is religious.
Okay.
So yeah. And again, it's one of those things where working in the field that I work, I see so much that I just cannot really explain through words, or it hasn't quite yet been proven, quote unquote, by science. And again, I'm a physician, I'm a scientist, right?
Yeah.
And so when I first started this, I was just like, nah, whatever, this is just wives' tales and woo-woo stuff and blah, blah, blah. But now I can't explain it, but I've seen it too often for it to just be coincidences, you know? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I'll give you some examples.
Like, yeah, I would love that. Thank you.
I've had numerous patients who I was like, they're not going to make it past, I don't know, a day or whatever, because their blood pressure was weak and, you know, they just looked like they were going to pass. And, you know, these people were unconscious. I had one lady who literally her pancreatic cancer was eroding through her belly button. Mm-hmm. And so she literally had a hole through like her skin, and it was pouring out, you know, 2 liters of ascites or abdominal fluid a day at like, you know, like a 2-liter soda bottle. And we had to connect a like a bag for normally used to collect urine for that, because otherwise like she would just you know, be wet all the time. Her daughter was across the country trying to fly in, couldn't get there for another 5 days. And I was like, this woman doesn't have 5 hours, much less 5 days. We told her, like, and again, she was unconscious, but we spoke to her and said, your daughter's coming, she's flying in, yada, yada, all this stuff. You know, she's coming in 5 days. And that woman held on. I have no idea how to this day. She held on. And then the daughter came. And then, I don't know, a few hours later, this woman passed. And that happens time and time again. Or sometimes, you know, they're waiting for a long lost family member to come or have a phone call. Or sometimes a family member is sitting vigil at the bedside and they're always there 24/7. And then the moment that they just go to get something from the vending machine, the patient passes. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just weird, weird things that, again, I can't quite explain, but I see so often that it just makes you think differently about, you know, your concept of reality.
Yeah. I mean, I completely agree. And I've seen exactly what you described like so many times. And I do think it's, I mean, especially people who wake up from coma say, oh, I heard everything, you know, like not all of them, but it's fascinating. And so I guess now is absolutely the perfect time to ask the pivotal question of the podcast, which is based on all of these life experiences, including your own near-death experience, including watching, you know, people die for a living and diagnosing and seeing people survive diagnoses and whatnot, what do you think is going to happen to you when you die?
Hey, everyone. Thank you so much for listening to Coffin Talk. I am proud to say that we are offering premium subscriptions at my website, mikeyopp.com. That's MikeyOpp.com. So please head over and consider supporting us. Thank you so much.
So, yes, I personally, over the, I would say I've become much more spiritual over the past 1 to 2 years, and also based on other things that I've experienced. I have a pretty open mind. So I'm like, oh, you know, I'll try this and see, you know, when they talk about astrology and energy healers and all of this stuff. And so I'm like, my sense is kind of like, all right, I'll try it. And I'm a skeptic, but prove me wrong. Mm-hmm. And so based on those experiences, I do have to say that I personally believe that there's a spirit, a soul of some sort that in essence occupies this physical human form of existence, and that spirit or soul will have some sort of experience afterwards. Yeah. What that is, I have no idea. I am curious to find out, but from everything that I've seen from patients who are literally unconscious, but like are transitioning, and they'll be like, I see blah, blah, blah. And they'll call someone's name who has already passed over. Mm-hmm. Again, unprompted. And they just, you know, that that's happening. And then a couple minutes later, they are physically declared deceased. I can't explain that, but I've seen it too often for me to say that this is where it ends in the physical realm. I don't believe that that's true.
Yeah. And I don't want to speak for you, but I definitely feel like in the Western world, we have this weird thing where if something is not explainable, it's not true. And I just think that's crazy, because to me, science is all about hypotheses and then figuring out how to measure and detect things that we want to understand. So I just feel like consciousness, you know, we were talking about like people waiting and holding on when you're speaking to them when they're technically on their deathbed and things like that, are things that someday we're going to get, you know, more sensitive equipment and be able to understand. And actually, mm-hmm. that does segue nicely into my next question, which is, I love hypnosis. And the reason I love it is I was a hopelessly addicted cigarette smoker who quit like every year for at least a month. And no matter how hard I tried, I couldn't, as I call it, stay quit. And so I finally, much like your attitude that you said, like, I'm a skeptic, but prove me wrong. I was like, fine, I'll just go to a hypnotist. Someone said it works. And I went, and sure enough, never smoked again. Unbelievable. So now I rave about hypnosis. So I'm curious, did you become a hypnotist like concurrently with being in medical school and stuff? Or is that something newer in your life?
No, that's awesome. I would love to hear a little bit more about what they did or your experience with hypnosis. But no, I basically, through working in hospice and palliative care, I heard so many regrets of the dying, like, oh, I wish I had done this. I wish I had spoken up for myself. I wish I had gone for that thing, but I was too scared to do. And then I felt like I couldn't do much to help them with those regrets when their time was so limited at the end. And so I was like, well, what if I could shift those regrets and share them with people decades earlier? And then that was only the part that would only be part of the thing. If I share the regrets, then people are like, okay, cool, but how do I actually take action? How do I change things so that I don't have the regrets at the end of life? And then so I was like, okay, you know what? I'll be a coach. I got some coach training, and part of it was hypnosis and neuro-linguistic programming. And I saw how effectively and efficiently it worked because we were doing practice sessions on each other in class. Cool. And then I was like, oh my God, I have to do this. So I got my hypnosis training, but never in my life did I think I'd be like, you know what? I'm a hypnotist in addition to, you know, my medical training. But it is, it makes so much sense because so much of everything that we believe or really are not even aware of that makes us who we are, positive and negative, is unconscious, right? It's like the iceberg theory. Well, it's like the iceberg, you know, 5, maybe 7% of our consciousness is above the surface level of the water, us thinking, speaking, that sort of thing, and everything else, 95 to 97% is unconscious. And so I'm curious, like, what do you remember what they did in hypnosis that got you to finally quit?
Actually, I remember it's so strange. And I always tell the story the same way, and I'll be as brief as possible. But I went into a room, and a very nice guy, you know, he's the hypnotist, and we'd spoken on the phone. This was in 2010, and it was exactly $500. And I remember not only was that a ton of money for someone who was in grad school at the time and taking out heavy loans, but it was just like preposterous that I was going to spend that much money on, you know, what I thought was a lark. So I go in and he's like, all right, close your eyes. And I'm going to talk for a little bit. And then when I like bring you back to attention, you're going to be cured. And I was like, okay, whatever, you know, very skeptical, not rude. I'm a polite, nice person. And, you know, I'm sure he deals with that all the time. But anyway, what I remember so specifically is he kept talking about walking in circles around hay bales. And I just remember that's the only thing I remembered. And it went on for about like 3 to 5 minutes, maybe 10. And then he goes, okay, how do you feel? And I was like, okay. And I was like on the verge of saying, accept the fact that you just fleeced me for $500 and talked about hay bales for 10 minutes. And he goes, look at the clock. And I just look up to the left and it had been an hour and 45 minutes. And I mean, that was it. I was just like stymied. I could not believe that much time had passed, especially because I'm a very impatient person and I'm constantly watching the clock. And I even have an internal sense of time that is like almost uncanny because I used to teach and I could not look at the clock in the classroom and know exactly when the bell is going to ring. I'm very good at like experiencing time and knowing what's passing. And so not only did that blow my mind, but then he said, you're not even going to be tempted, but just in case, here's like 5 colored tabs, put them in places where you used to smoke. And so I put one in the car, one blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I got on a plane, flew to my brother's wedding, went to his bachelor party, held a friend's cigarette outside the bars like all night, didn't even want to drag, and the rest is history. So that was my experience, and it was unbelievable. And then actually, I wanted to ask you another question, so I'll volley with you real quick. Today of all days, before this interview, I was actually reading something, and I was starting to think about what you describe are limiting beliefs. And I was wondering, with hypnosis, can you just like hypnotize a person to believe that they're like awesome? And what would that do to them?
Okay. That's really fascinating. So first of all, I love that the way that you recounted the story, because that happens a lot where people are just like, oh, it was just 10 minutes. And it turns out you've been in trance or, you know, the state of being hypnotized for like an hour plus, because it just blurs time and people are just like, whoa, what happened? So when it comes to limiting beliefs and like hypnotizing them into feeling awesome, it's not as if like I think a lot of people think about it as like, oh, I'm just pretending, right? Like you make me think a belief or feel something, and then that's not actually true. Or like, it feels like you're just trying on a new dress in a sense. But when you do it in hypnosis, and it basically blurs the normal distinction between conscious and unconscious. Our unconscious is always there. It's always happening. Like, we're always breathing, but we're not aware that we're breathing. Our hearts are beating, but we're not controlling how our heart is beating, right? And the same mm-hmm. thing with our thoughts and our emotions and feelings that may come up. And so a lot of times I will work with people, regular people, professionals, especially also business owners, on confidence. And when I do it in trance and hypnosis, it really is about helping people to kind of tap into their own inner knowledge and also wiping away the things that are preventing them from feeling confident. So for some people, that is their body image. You know, maybe they're carrying more weight than they want to be. For some people, that is, you know, their perception of how other people are judging them or might be judging them based on certain things. And so it's almost twofold. It's like kind of dismantling and rewiring the neural associations that are in place that keep people thinking that they're not good enough or reasons why they shouldn't feel good about themselves, and then bolstering the inner confidence and reminding them of reasons that maybe they've forgotten about or maybe they have hidden down of why they actually can feel good about themselves, why they can feel confident and feel awesome, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it really does. And I'm fascinated by all this because I know my mom, when she saw how easily I quit smoking with hypnotism, she immediately asked me to ask the guy who did it, can you help me with weight loss? And he said, it's really complicated because you're supposed to eat. And I can't just like program your subconscious to hate food and not want food. Plus that would like destroy one of the great pleasures of life. So that's why today I was kind of tangentially thinking, like, I know some people who I wish they would go to a hypnotist who would take away the level of awesomeness they think. And then I know many more people who need a boost in it. So it's just interesting that I was really primed to ask you these kind of questions. You already mentioned, you know, being a hypnotist. You mentioned that you're a healthy skepticist and that now that you are, you know, as devout into the notions of spirituality as one could be. I'm curious because I have a stereotype, it's mine, which is most people in the medical field are not open to word choices like integrative life coach and limiting beliefs and hypnosis and stuff. Again, my stereotype. I am curious though, could you help me disband that? Or what is it like in your experiential process of the last 10, 15 years in New York City of all places, where there's just a lot of doctors and a lot of medical professionals? Are you up against the odds? Is it moving in the favor of people like yourself? Like what's kind of the vibe?
It is a really, really great question. And there's layers to this. I'll try to explain it as best as I can think. But I think the needle is moving. And again, I think it also depends on the circles each person runs in, right? Like I live in a very large metropolitan urban environment, and I work in hospice and palliative care, which in general, you know, we deal with a lot more, I guess, inherent, if you want to call it, mysticism or things that we can't quite explain. Whereas I think for a lot of people in the medical community, it is all about academics, all about randomized controlled trials and the evidence and that sort of thing. And so there is definitely some tension, I would say, when it comes to helping people to maybe embrace some of these things. And at the same time, you know, there are integrative medicine fellowships. There is lifestyle medicine now. You know, there's the rise of functional medicine. I think in pop culture too, you're seeing a lot of people who are kind of advocating for alternative health that wasn't a thing really a decade, two decades earlier, where back then it was probably a little bit more fringe. So I do think the needle is moving, and at the same time, there is still a lot of work to be done. And I think when it comes to, there's a difference in generational attitudes as well. People who probably were trained earlier may or may not be as embracing of these things as people who are maybe coming up through medical school or other types of medical training now. So all that to say is I am super happy and excited with the development of my own spirituality and that sort of thing. And I see it in other people as well. And I'm excited to see how that unfolds for everyone.
That's awesome. Yeah, I feel the same way. I definitely feel like there's a huge shift. And I also feel like, thankfully, that's going to hopefully settle what I see as a not national culture war at all, but just a globalized, like, every culture is coming together. So it's not a war. I don't see it as a war. But, like, you know, it is going to be a little sticky for, like, all of these different dominant perspectives to come together because of the internet and just meeting each other the way we are. So I am optimistic. I don't think it's going to be quick or easy, but I do think it will happen. And I think your answer is more evidence that I'm collecting. As a matter of fact, I think this show is in general my attempt to collect evidence in with confirmation bias that more and more humans are becoming spiritual. It doesn't matter if you're also religious or not religious, but spirituality is very different from religion, and I appreciate that. So, and speaking of appreciation, I have so much appreciation for you, and I wish we could talk for longer, but the audience's demand, these podcasts are about 30 to 40 minutes, so I don't want to let you leave, though, without letting you talk about whatever it is you would most like our audience to hear, because you do so many fantastic things, so leave our audience with something special.
I think a lot of people think that... I'll just say this. I've talked to a lot of people at the end of life or who've had near-death experiences or something like that. And there's a common theme of, like, once that happens or they lose a loved one or their life was threatened, their whole perspective on life changes where they're like, oh my God. And my whole goal is that no one has to lose a loved one or have a near-death experience to be able to have that kind of shift and that perspective change, and all the life-changing things that happen with it, if they just know what to do. And so part of that is a perspective shift, like, oh my God, life is short. Oh my God, like, that could have been me. And then the other part of it is the emotion. Mm-hmm. So it's like, how do I tap into the emotion of that could have been me, or that, you know, life is short, or that person that I love just passed away suddenly and I didn't even get to say goodbye. And so part of it is really uncomfortable talking about it like you are on this podcast and all the work that you're doing. And part of it is just normalizing it and having these conversations and saying, like, death is as much a part of life as anything else. And that if we can make people feel a little bit better about the fact that maybe it isn't the end, and just that lingering possibility, I think will bring comfort to a lot of people who otherwise would feel really afraid of what happens when and after we die.
Oh, wow. Thank you so much. That was so wonderful. I am very confident after speaking with you for 30 plus minutes that you can help anyone with all of the things that you mentioned: limiting beliefs, perfectionism, imposter syndrome, self-doubt. And I'm just so glad that Hirsch had us meet each other. And I wish you the best in the future. And to everyone listening at home, the best way to support the podcast is to subscribe for free at mikeyopp.com. That's MikeyOpp.com. We also offer a premium subscription. But either way, we love you. We appreciate you. And my name is Mike Oppenheim. You have been listening to Coffin Talk, and we will see you soon.